When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This episode is sponsored by Hollywood Casino at Charlestown Races in West Virginia. Upcoming featured entertainment includes The Steel Woods on April 26th and Little River Band on May 3rd. Details and tickets at HollywoodCasinoCharlestown.com. Must be 21 to enter the casino floor and attend a show. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Welcome to the newest episode of Beyond the Fame with Jason Fraley. I'm your host, Jason Fraley, picking the brains of the top filmmakers, musicians, and artists of our time. Rock and Roll Hall of Famer John Mellencamp plays DAR Constitution Hall this Thursday night in Washington, D.C. I spoke to his longtime guitarist Mike Wanchick about playing on iconic hits like Hurt So Good, Jack and Diane, Pink Houses, Authority Song, and Small Town. Hey, Mike Wanchick, hey, thanks so much for joining us on WTOP in Washington, D.C.
You're more than welcome. Nice to be here.
We are talking, you're obviously the guitarist here for John Mellencamp coming to rock DAR Constitution Hall in Washington, D.C. on April 18th. And it's the live and in-person tour is what you're calling this. So what do we expect? Is this like all the greatest hits sprinkled in with, you know, the new album Orpheus Descending?
Yes. And, you know, the bottom line is after a career that we've been making records since 1976, you have to sort of cull, you know, there's a lot of songs that a lot of people hold really dear to their hearts. And you certainly want to touch on those things. I know when I see a Neil Young or somebody, I want to hear, you know, what I want to hear. Yeah. So we always try to use as many of those deep memory songs as we can in our set. I'm a fan of music, too. I know when I want to go see somebody that has a legend in songwriting, you have these songs that are so dear to you. And, you know, music is a major trigger for people's memories and emotions. And, you know, those are important things to people. And we can never disregard that. So there are certain songs that you are obliged to play. And we love to deliver those to our crowd. But conversely, you know, we're still making records. You know, we're 23 records into our career. We're still John's the best songwriter he's ever been right now. He's not on the down. He's on the up. So we're still making records, still making great music. And for us and for our creative vitality, we need to continue expanding our music beyond, you know, just a hit parade. So there's a good balance of all those things. There's good deep cuts. There's great hits. There's new material that'll challenge people too. It's a very well-balanced set.
I love it. It does sound like a little bit of past, present, future. That's what you need. I love it.
Well,
do you want to tease anything off the new album? I know it's called Orpheus Descending. I know there's one called Hey God, another one called The Eyes of Portland. Just give our listeners, you know, if they're huge Mellencamp fans, like I am, like a lot of us, you know, it's just great American rock music, heartland rock, if you will. But, you know, tease maybe if they haven't picked up the new one, you know, what's sort of the vibe?
Well, Hey God is an absolutely amazing song. To me, that's the most amazing song on the record, but it has relevance on all fronts, political, personal, familial, all these different things are touched on in this song. And it's, you know, a bit of a slice of today's political environment. It's a remarkable record. John's still writing beautifully. We'll probably be heading into a studio and making yet another record soon. But we try to keep, you know, the new material to very choice songs. We're not going to like glut people with it and play the entire new record because it's something people want. You know,
I've been to those shows before too. I went to a Bob Dylan show and it was like a bunch of stuff. No one knew.
Okay. I hear you. And I'm a huge Dylan fan. And we're actually
of course.
I've been to shows where it was like, what was that? You know,
exactly.
Because, yeah, there's like hundreds of songs that we would know, and he picks the ones that you don't. But it's all right.
Well, yeah. Well, he could be persnickety, you know, just by nature. But still, you know, the greatest songwriter of the 20th century.
Of course. When you reach a certain level, you sort of can do whatever the hell you want. People pay the
ticket. Exactly. Yeah. It's like, exactly. You know, you're just lucky to be in his presence.
Yeah, exactly. Well said. Well, we'll be lucky to be in your all's presence too, because I mean, man, the hits that you all have done with John Mellencamp are unbelievable. I'd love to run through some of them, but before we do any of that, though, when did you actually meet John Mellencamp? Was he John Cougar Mellencamp at that time, or what iteration was he?
It was Johnny Mellencamp. I met him, and I finished college right around 1976, and I was interning at a recording studio in Bloomington, Indiana, because in the old days, you were not able to go to Berklee School of Music or Indiana University recording department and learn audio engineering. The only way you could learn it was through internship. And there was a drummer at the University of Indiana. His name was Jack Guilfoy. He was the drummer for Henry Mancini Orchestra.
Oh, wow.
Johnny Mathis and some of the greatest, you know, big jazz bands in the world. He had a state-of-the-art studio in Bloomington. And I went down and just basically badgered my way into an internship. And so I was there like scrubbing toilets and cutting tape and, you know, just doing the really nasty work of an intern and the Sorcerer's Apprentice as such. And
scrubbing toilets, the Moon River as a new meaning, a whole new meaning.
Hey, well said. And, and was making his very first demos, and that's where I met him.
Oh, that's so cool. What was that initial meeting like? What were you like, this guy's, he's insanely talented, or did it sort of take a bit to realize?
Oh, yeah, obviously talented and insane on top of it. I mean, just like really super energy, raw, you know, really raw, you know, and the record was, he was just making demos to try to get a record deal. And he had a guitarist who was marginally competent. And after those sessions, I'd go in and I'd kind of just overdo some of those parts and just overdub them. And that's how we met. And then we had about a year and a half hiatus where I went on off with another group that I was working with. He went off to England and scored a record deal. And then he came back. And in 78, I joined him full time.
Gotcha. Yeah, exactly. And so then if you joined in 78 full time, then you were there for basically all the biggest hits that we can talk about, because American Fool album was what, 82? So yeah, you would have already been on there for along for the ride. So let's run through them, and there, obviously there's so many that we'd be here all day if we had, you know, in-depth dives into all of them. So maybe we should almost treat it almost more like a rapid fire. So I'll throw out a title and you can just share a quick memory or something. But I know that first album, Hurt So Good and Jack and Diane, memories of putting those two together.
Those are long months, you know, because we were still searching for what we were trying to do. We were boiled down to, at that point, nothing but two guitar players and a drummer and John, no bass player to speak of when it came to American Fool. We hired a guy in Los Angeles. We worked on Jack and Diane for a long, long time. We were started it in Miami at Criteria Studios, and we were just trying to lay down an acoustic guitar track with some sort of metronomic timekeeper. And of all things, the Bee Gees were in the studio next to us, and Maurice Gibb came by our studio and said, "I've got this new little drum machine. Would you like to try it?" And so he brought in very earliest Lynn drum machines, and it had that that little backbeat that we used in Jack and Diane, but we really were only using it just to cut the acoustic, and then we went ahead and kept it, and that's sort of the genesis of that song.
Wow, thank you. It was just a little ditty, and then that turned into a legend. and what about Hurt So Good? Because man, that is a classic rock anthem. Come on, baby.
Oh yeah. That we actually had moved to Los Angeles by this time to continue working on the record. And we were just two guitars, hired bass player and Kenny Aronoff on drums and John. And so it was just a little svelte little package of three musicians and our singer, you know. And we worked so hard, like that little hook line of da 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 da. Larry and I played that must have been 500 times because we didn't want to overdub it. We wanted to play it at the same time because that gives a certain kind of phasing to the guitar sound. So we just kept on it. And I recall there's a great little tale that I'll probably shouldn't tell it all. And that we had one of the record company presidents from PolyGram was sent over to hear what we were doing at Cherokee Studios in Los Angeles at that time during American Fool. And we'd had a hit, a top 40 hit, our first top 40 hit, which was Ain't Even Done With The Night, the year before. And that was more of a blue-eyed soul song.
Yeah.
You know, pretty boy, pretty love song. And the guy came into the session and we played him Hurt So Good. And he obviously didn't get it. And he looked at John, he goes, maybe we should put horns on it. And John blew his top.
Yeah.
And walked over to the side door of the studio, invited him to walk over with it, and then shoved him out the side door of the studio and closed it. He ejected the president of the record company and said, you don't like it? Give us the record back. And they reluctantly released the album, and it had two number one songs on it. So guy probably didn't keep his job anyway.
No. Great stories. That's so good. Thanks for Jack and Diane and Hurt So Good. And I always liking that song, but where he goes all night long, the little huh.
Oh, thank you, Elvis. Thank you.
Oh yeah, that's a little John Elvis Mellencamp. All right. All right. Moving on to in 83, Crumbling Down's another great one. We probably don't have time for all these, but all right, Pink Houses. I mean, Ain't That America for You and Me.
Yeah.
That's probably the most like American heartland rock I can think of. It's literally the American dream, man. I mean, is that why it works, you think?
Well, it is, but it's there's a counterpoint to it. Yes, it's a lot of the great things about America, but it's also points out a lot of the inequities, that exist in America, where a kid thinks he can do anything and maybe he can't, there's a young man in a t-shirt, listening to a rock and roll station. He's got greasy hair, greasy guy. And he said, this must be my destination. There's all kinds of, little innuendo woven inside the lyric of that song. Right. That it's a little more satirical than I think a lot of people think that it is.
I thank you for that. It's almost like, the people that shout Born in the USA, and really it's like a critique of that's great. That's like a American Dream satire where it's like, that America? Like,
That is absolutely what it really is.
I love that. Thank you. And then of course, kind of ties into the same record. I fight authority. Authority always wins. Authority song. Talk about sort of how Mellencamp and the rest of y'all, a little rebel nature in that song.
Well, we have grown up. We grew up in the music business, particularly at our beginning. Everybody hated us. Nobody liked us. Nobody thought we'd do shit. There was nobody rooting for us. We were the kids from the Midwest, that didn't know anything, that had funny accents, that dressed weird and, were not cool when we went to L.A. And the Authority song is kind of that's kind of what it's saying. Everybody's, trying to punch you down, but you got to just, stick to your guns. And that was actually done. That record was done in a farmhouse in a tiny, tiny little hamlet in the middle of Indiana. That John knew a friend of his who's building a house. And he said, I tell you what, Jeff, let us turn your house into a studio for 2 months and I'll help you finish your house. And he said, okay. So we came, ripped out the living room, put this recording studio in it, and threw a piece of glass in a wall so we could see through the other room. And we made the record into this guy's house.
Wow. It wasn't a pink house, was it?
It
was different.
It was not a pink house.
But all right. So I like that. All right. Yeah. You're doing it since you were a young kid and you came out grinning.
That's right.
All these crazy alien stories can't be true, can they? Hey, it's Stephen Diener, host of the Unidentified Alien Podcast. And whether you're new to the conversation or have been looking into it for years, you need to check out the fastest growing alien show out there, the Unidentified Alien Podcast, or UAP for short. There's a crazy amount of alien encounter stories out there from all over the world. And the beauty of it is that I bring them all to you and let you decide what you believe. Download and subscribe to UAP on any of the major podcasting platforms. And you can also find it on UAP Podcast.com.
I'm Bradley Trainer,
and I'm Don McClain. We have a podcast called Blinded by the Item.
A blind item is gossip about a celebrity with their name left out. It's a guessing game, and you can play along. The item might be like, this A-list star carries a Birkin bag worth more than the average person's house to the gym to work out.
Pretty sure that's J-Lo.
And P.S. the person behind all of this is Kris Jenner,
LLC. We drop a new episode every weekday so the fun never ends.
Blinded by the Item. Listen wherever you get podcasts and watch us on the Blinded by the Item YouTube channel.
Well, we have to hit Scarecrow album 85. We have to. Lonely Old Night, R.O.C.K. in the USA. Some really catchy stuff. But tell me about Small Town. That one is one of the catchier ones. But what about you?
Oh, agreed. I agree. And it really does sort of tell the tale, you know, of who we are and what we are and who John is and how it's never really changed. I mean, I still live here in Bloomington. John has a house here in Bloomington. You know, we're just small town guys, you know, and that's, man, we are. And it's like, you know, Mike Mills is a close friend of mine from REM, and they're kind of the same boat. You know, they grew up in Athens, Georgia. That was their town. And Mike still lives there. You know, I see no reason to go anywhere else. I am a small town guy and I really enjoy it. And there's a moral fiber, you know, to the Midwest, and there's a moral fiber to small town America that is sort of undeniable and is part of the charm of America, you know, and you lose that, you lose the identity of America. You know, you become, you know, the corporate, you know, strip mall, you know, and yeah. That's what we don't want to see happen.
Yeah. Great, great subject matter. Absolutely. And born and live and probably die in the same small town. And,
damn
and
right.
By the way, and deceptively, intricate, challenging lyric to pull off too, to repeat the same line at the end of each whatever stanza,
absolutely,
you know what I mean, born in a small town, taught to fear Jesus in a small town, like that's hard to do.
I can recall when some of my quote-unquote musical snobby friends heard it for the first time, they kept going, small town, small town, small town, small town, why do you keep saying small town? Yeah. Well, we're still saying small town.
It's all right to be a little bitty, Alan Jackson.
That's right.
Lonesome Jubilee. I promise we're not going to go through all of them, so we won't keep you all day. But we have to hit Lonesome Jubilee really quick. Paper and Fire, Cherry Bomb, and Check It Out. And memories of that album. How do you think you guys were evolving by that time?
I think that this album, in my opinion, Scarecrow and Jubilee were the pinnacle of a lot of the writing at that time, where everything came together. And particularly if you're talking about Jubilee, we have, every time we went away from a record, we would take the time, like months, maybe a year off, not maybe sometimes not that long, but we would go and we would try to find new musical inspiration to bring back to the fold. So after Scarecrow, which was still, you know, guitar, bass, drums record, John says, hey, man, let's all go out and let's learn another instrument. So yeah, I went away and worked on banjo, worked on dobro, people worked on steel. We picked up Lisa Germano, a fiddle player here in Bloomington. We had a great keyboard player named John Casella, who was an incredible like B3 player, traditional organ player. And John says to him one day, when we're kind of discussing this matter, he goes, hey, John, you play anything else? And he goes, no, I play accordion. And reluctantly, because what was the uncoolest instrument on the planet,
right?
You know,
unless you need Weird Al, you know.
And it turns out that the guy John Casella was the junior state champion accordion player in New Jersey.
Wow!
So once we figured that out, he was locked on, and that's when we started like doing instrument combinations in order to get different sounds, like combining like a banjo with a dobro, a violin with an accordion, like on the hook line of Check It Out, or Paper and Fire. I mean, da, 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 da. Yeah. The reason that sounds like that is because it's an accordion and a violin playing dead on the same thing, and the phasing between them and the different timbres combining. So that was kind of the genesis of that musical sound for that record. And John's writing was just at its pinnacle.
Mm, Man, I'm just smiling my face off going through all of these songs because it's like the soundtrack of so many of our lives, man. I love it, and I've been enjoying all these breakdowns. Now, I have to admit though, I'm gonna underdate myself or whatever. I was born in 84, so my parents showed me a lot of these, but my era was more like Whenever We Wanted and Human Wheels and, you know, the Dance Naked Out. Like, I remember the Wild Night cover, the Van Morrison. That was a cool cover. But anyway, it just echoes down to the generations. It's timeless stuff. I mean, we're spoiled, but, you know, you all, Mellencamp and Seeger and Springsteen, I mean, you all just painted a picture of our country, our heartland.
Right. I mean, the thing is, it's their songs. All of the people you just mentioned wrote songs, you know, from the heart. They were not corporately designed. They were not anticipating a two minute and 58 second single. You know, all those things didn't apply, particularly in the early days. There were no rules. You could have a I Need a Lover with a 3 minute intro if you wanted to. It didn't matter. You know, you think about those songs, even by like Kansas and some of these other bands that were very, you know, progressive kind of, you know, arrangements. Yeah. There were no rules. And that was what was great about it. You could just make music for the sake of music.
Well, you don't even know what you're dropping right now, because we just talked to Kansas. We just we just talked to the guitarist, Rich Williams, the other day.
Wow. Wow. See, we did opened up some shows for them. And I thought, man, particularly Steve Walsh was an amazing singer.
They can kick ass. Dare I say underrated of the 70s bands, but they're still going. 50th anniversary tour, I think.
Yeah, agreed. Fantastic.
Yeah, but you all, you know, Mellencamp, not underrated at all. Inducted into the Rock Hall of Fame in 08, Songwriters Hall of Fame in 2018. So I'm glad you plugged his songwriting credentials. I agree. One of the greatest ever to do it. Did you get to go to that and perform with them or anything, or how did that work?
Well, certainly at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, yeah, we were all there and on stage and being recognized. Songwriter, no, I wasn't there for that. You know, those honors come up quite a bit. I have my own life, a pile of children. You know, when John receives an individual award, he usually just heads off and does it.
Right. Well, yeah, your own children are the most important honor, honestly. So that's cool. Well, real quick, final seconds. Didn't you all do? I mean, I want to dote on sort of the philanthropic stuff. Weren't you a huge part of getting Farm Aid off the ground too?
Yes, one of the four original people that got it off the ground. I was actually inducted into the Farm Aid, quote unquote, Hall of Fame 2 years ago.
Oh, there you go.
They honor one person a year. And I've been the musical producer for the Farm Aid records and a consultant with Farm Aid, you know, from the beginning. And yes, it's something that held really dear to John's heart. His sister and brother-in-law lost a farm during that Scarecrow era, and that was part of one of the things that sort of pushed, you know, that song Scarecrow to get written. Yes, Farm Aid is still vital, still happening. It'll be happening again next September yet again.
Well, there you go. In a place like Washington, D.C., you know, these causes like that are appreciated. So, well,
and
bravo with the Farm Aid. Yeah, see, I didn't even realize. I was dropping the Rock Hall of Fame and stuff. Didn't even realize you got in the Farm Aid Hall of Fame. There you go.
But if you want to get a bang for your buck and see some amazing music, Farm Aid's the place to go. You can see, you know, Chris Stapleton or, you know, any number of, like, you know, stadium headliners all on the same bill, same day. Neil Young, yeah. You know, Willie, ourselves, Dave Matthews, always, you know, we're always there.
That's awesome.
And then
when is the next one, by the way?
It's, I think, next September 21st, and I can't recall exactly where it is. It moves around the United States every year.
Okay, gotcha. Man, that's it's an amazing thing that you put together with that. So congrats and bravo.
Well, thank you.
Well, but we'll stay tuned for that. We'll plug that, you know, once it comes around. But first, everybody, you have to check out John Mellencamp and, of course, the guitarist we're talking to now, Mike Wanchick. at DAR Constitution Hall in DC on April 18th. Now that I think about it, that is the same venue where literally like a couple weeks before that, Elton John and Bernie Taupin have just received the Library of Congress Gershwin Prize in DAR.
Right.
So some of the magic will still be floating around the room, baby.
Oh, fantastic. Well, you know, funny enough, I just recall the first time I played that room was we were opening up for the Kinks in 1978.
Oh, wow. Now you really got me now. I mean, that's good.
I got you that time. I had a couple synapses just accidentally connect.
They're firing randomly a lot of these interviews all day and all of the night.
Right.
Well, hey, thank you so much. I really appreciate it. And thanks for all the great music. Seriously, all these songs, they're amazing.
Well, we look forward to seeing you guys.
Thanks so much for listening to Beyond the Fame with Jason Fraley. Our theme music is Scott Buckley's Clarion. Remember to give us a 5-star rating if you like what you hear. We'll see you next time.